This is an ABC podcast.
Jack Charles is now in his 70s. Jack is an actor who's performed in some classic Australian films and stage productions. Jack's a respected elder now and a former Victorian Senior of the Year. But he's also been a cat burglar and a heroin addict, and he's been incarcerated 22 times. Jack doesn't do any of that stuff now, and he thinks he can help young Aboriginal kids who are like he once was, confused and angry and profoundly disconnected from their culture. Throughout his childhood, Jack Charles had no idea who his mother was. And when he went looking for her, he got arrested because it was illegal for him to even try. Jack has had a wild, wild life. And despite several bouts of bad behaviour, somehow he's getting more and more handsome as he gets older. Jack has written a completely engrossing memoir, which I devoured in one great big hit. And just a quick warning, his story does contain some pretty confronting elements. Jack Charles's book is called Born Again Blackfella. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Richard. Very good to be on your show here.
What is your beauty secret? I am 20 years younger than you and I look like crap. You look fantastic. What's your secret, Jack?
I don't know. I might have the right black jeans, you know. Sometimes I'm wearing them. Sometimes you see it in my face. And I always like to tell people I look so devilishly handsome because I'm off to drugs.
Well, so am I.
Yeah, but I mean, my drug-addled body had survived all that, and I think once you clean yourself, once you're abiding by the doctor's orders, once you're true to yourself, somehow or another, you have this fresh complexion. And I'm 76 this year. I occasionally look in the mirror of a morning. I see the feral look, and then I see the face, and that, you know, I'm just totally amazed that I look as good as I do, even without both the teeth in.
Where were you born, Jack?
I was born in Royal Women's Hospital, Grattan Street, Carlton, in 1943, September. And Mum had managed to take me to Dash's Paddock between Melbourne and Shepparton and Maroopna, and Dash's Paddock, a blackfella camp there, rubbish dump.
So you were taken from your mother?
From there at 4 months and then delivered to the City Mission Babies Home in Brunswick. And when I got too big, at 2 years old, a little note was attached to me and I was delivered to Box Hill Boys Home.
What was the...
I was taken under the assimilation policy, remember. So I didn't get that criminal record that most people got when they were taken in the 50s.
When you were taken to Box Hill Boys Home, yeah, that was a Salvation Army place.
Yes, yes.
What was the place like? Would you describe the building for me?
There was one great big huge mansion at the front. It still stands, as a matter of fact. But the rest of them were huts. There were three different homes and that. And the main buildings were solid edifices. And they had verandas and et cetera. But, all built there, and we were being raised for future wars and that, soldiers of the cross.
Did you like that kind of muscular Salvation Army Christianity back then when you were a kid?
Well, you know, I was the only Aboriginal kid there, and I liked the marching, I liked the songs, I liked the music. I was so whitewashed in the blood of the Lamb of Jesus Christ at one stage, Richard, I wanted to be the donkey carrying Jesus over the palm leaves. So that's how whitewashed I had become.
You wanted to be the donkey on Palm
carrying,
Sunday.
Carrying
Jesus.
Walking into Jerusalem.
Why not the disciple? That's interesting.
No, I wanted to be the donkey because the woman running the Bible classes, wouldn't you like to be the donkey carrying Jesus over to palm leaves with everyone waving at Jesus? I said, yes, miss, I'd like to be the donkey carrying Jesus. I have fond memories of that.
How did you get on with the other boys, being the only Aboriginal kid?
Well, I got on well. Really, you know, basically, I've met fellas, you know, knocking on my door or in the course of doing, you know, touring Jack Charles versus the Crown, former comrades. I like to meet people in the foyer after the show, and many of them remembered me from Box Hill Boys Home. Naturally, I couldn't remember any of them, but it was significant, truly, you know, locked in the notion that I was the only registered Aboriginal kid there, and those guys remembered me.
You write about how you and the other boys were abused by a particularly vile sexual predator in that place. One of the staff.
A few of them.
It wasn't just the one.
Well, I I was approached in my last jail sentence by my former comrades. We're all collecting our methadone at Port Phillip Prison. And they said to me, Jack, do you remember us from Box Hill Boys Home? I couldn't remember them, of course. And they said, well, Jack, we remember you. We are part of a class action against the Box Hill Boys Home and Officer so-and-so and Major so-and-so and Captain so-and-so. So we'd like your phone number to give to the class action lawyers, because I believe you're the best bloke, Jack, to give credence and validate the stories of what went on in the Box Hill Boys Home. So sure enough, I gave them my phone number, and shortly after I was booted out of the jail, Ryan, Carl and Thomas rang me, and I gave them a story over the phone. Yes, this happened and that happened, but really, basically, I was the first person that he approached. My bed was the first person he approached, because it was right opposite his little cubbyhole attached to the dormitory. So I was first up, and I remember it, you know, laying there like a mouse when a snake is about to pounce, and that, and being interfered with, and that, and it was brutal, and it was regular, and it was something to be tolerated, and none of us ever spoke about it. I remember after Varsity came out, there was an edited version on the ABC, and some fellas had phoned up Ryan Carl on we just saw Jackie Charles on the television. We thought he was dead, but we'd like to tell you what happened to him. So I had some stories validated about some of the cruel and unusual punishments that I'd totally forgotten or put in the back of my mind, and some sexual escapade that I had to endure. So it wasn't until this time, years later, that we guys got to talk about it.
How does it feel talking about this now, after all this time, Jack?
Well, it got even worse once the Catholic stories started to come out and were published, and that. It took me into great depressions and that, you know. But I live with my depressions. I have to live with it. I get a guitar close by in my unit, and I just sort of sing myself out of them. But it never goes away.
Does talking about it help?
Talking about it is just fantastic. That actually, I got from the Salvos, I got $100,000 because it was proven beyond a shadow of doubt that this happened, because so many people gave evidence about me. So I was given $100,000 for what went on in Box Hill Boys Home.
You're a bookish kid. Were there places where you could go in that home and be alone?
Yes, up a tree at the back of the school.
And when you were up that tree?
Well, talking with the Maggies, and they never pounced on me or dived on me. I used to do it regularly, you know, up a tree at the weekends, away from the maddening mobs.
You said it was in this home that you learnt the art of acting, Jack. How so?
When you were naughty, you were forced to put on boxing gloves and be locked in the gym with a bigger kid. And I remember now being bashed by a couple of the kids. I was a naughty boy, apparently. You know, didn't turn up at the muster or something like that. It was late for dinner. So I was naughty, and often I was punished. But there was one kid in the home who flatly twice to bash me. And he said, Jack, we're locked up in here alone, okay? I'm not going to hit you. You know, but you're going to have to make out I've been hitting you. We'll make some sounds, okay? So, and just before I yell out to open the door, I'm going to slap you, because I know it's going to make you cry, Jack, okay? So I was doing, you know, he was thumping his fist into the leather, and whack, whack, you know. and then he'd slap me in the face, and I would tear up and come out crying, sniffling.
Right. That'd be enough.
That'd be enough. They believed you. He said, so that was my acting. But no, you have to, you know, act a lot. You know, we kids are resilient. And there were some times, I had to act against the bigger bullyish kids. With the Salvation Army officers, it was all on act. With the ladies, I put on a good act, because I endeared myself to them, and that I was allowed into the kitchen even. Well, Mrs. Johnson was stirring the porridge, And we had a wonderful time because I witnessed her teeth falling into the porridge one time, and she had to scoot them out and wash them. And we had a good old laugh, and we had keep this quiet, Jackie.
It's like you do have a very beguiling voice. Have you always been charming? Do you think then has that stood you in good stead, Jack?
Yes. Well, there was a teacher in the home who took me aside, and he gave me personally after hours, non-sexual, nothing like that. Felt really comfortable with him, and he taught me elocution lessons, gave me elocution lessons. The rain in Spain, all that kind of shit.
The rain in Spain, you were Eliza Doolittle, were you?
Yeah, I was an Eliza Doolittle, a little black Eliza Doolittle. And he died, and I was really upset. And I remember being bashed by the bigger boys for crying at this fella's. But I was really taken with that fella. He really, you know, and the head teacher, you know, just before I left the home, you know, going on to 14, I remember him hugging me closely, and it wasn't one of those sexual hugs. It was a hug, on reflection and looking at him, he must have thought I was going to leave a terrible life once I left the home. And it so happened that it wasn't so terrible.
Did you have any sense of your Aboriginality then, Jack?
All I knew was that I was Aboriginal.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, I was a black fella, one of the fellas that killed Captain Cook, the boys told me.
That was Hawaii. That's crazy.
Yeah, well, I was told, and that's why I was sometimes, jumped upon sometimes.
Did you ever sense you being a second-class citizen for being a black kid back then?
No, I was a bit of a novelty.
You're exotic then?
I was an exotic species, you know. Chosen specifically by the Salvos to be in the right spot at the right time to showcase. I do remember going to a big Salvation Army exhibition at the exhibition buildings, and I was paired with this pretty girl my size. We were there to hand over some posies to those in braid on the dais. She curtsied, so I curtsied. Causes a stir and a rumbling amongst the Salvationists, but me, I enjoyed the attention. But I had been trained to sing a song. I was specially chosen to sing on the big stage of God, I like to say. And shall I sing this last, the chorus?
Please.
One tribe, the Yarra Yarra, dwelling right here, mid thick bush and gum trees tall, with feast through boomerang and hurled their sharp spears, they knew every bird bush call. Often went walk about and camp far away, everybody free as air, running into forest trees, swimming into Yarra stream, life went on without no care. Kookaburra laugh with gladness, kangaroo jump for joy, Aborigine throw his boomerang, forest birds a gay merry tune sang. There amid the bright yellow blossom, bright and wild a red gum flamed. Everybody lived in gladness, all because a white man came. Now you can see how white was what I was.
I wasn't ready for that punchline at the end. I wasn't ready
for
that,
Well, I was
Jack.
A kid, an orphan annie.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for making
I
the white man for making the world so
in,
lovely.
Mate, because it's part of who I am, great
of
memories of being the chosen one,
to sing.
Especially in the Salvation Army.
So you left Box Hill Boys' home at the age of 14, and you were taken into a foster home. It was run by a widow, Mrs. Murphy. Who was she? Tell me about her, please.
She worked up in the cottage factory. She was the mother of a woman that had taken me out often, Norman Nichols, and Kevin Nichols, her husband. They come in and pick me up in their Austin A7. I'd endeared myself to her.
She had sons, two
sons. She had
sons.
Two bodgy sons.
Bodgies, yeah,
yes,
like
they were
bodgies, right.
And they were apprentice mechanics.
And were they nice to you?
They were lovely to me. You know, they dinked me around on their bikes.
Were you considering becoming a bodgy yourself, Jack, at that
point?
Well,
yes, I wanted to sew pipe pants, but Mrs. Murphy wouldn't allow me. You know, see, Fletcher Jones I got instead.
I know. I've seen pictures of you at that time, and you really are like a very, very presentable young man.
Oh, well, very presentable, mate. Oh, yes, she looked after me. I've seen some of the letters that she'd written to the Aboriginal Welfare Board to get more funding for clothing and etc.
How did you like family life for the first time?
Well, it was a great experience, but at every turn, you know, she did knock me back from my queries about my mum. I had experienced in the home before I left some experiences that led me to believe that I did have family. I wasn't an orphan as she and the Welfare Board insisted that I was.
Did you have an inkling that you might be gay at that point?
Yes. Yes, even at that age.
And being a member of the church as it was back then, did that frighten you or not bother you at all?
Not bother me, but I never liked playing footy for Blackburn United. And that, you know, because it was too tempting. And I was a loner. I kept to myself, and even though I had a group outside the 10 Tyrrell Avenue mob.
So you got a job at a glass factory.
Glass beveling factory.
And the boss there.
Lovely bloke.
Introduced you to all sorts of interesting people.
Yes. He'd always bring around his mates to meet the little Aboriginal boy working in the back there. And one time he brought around this bloke. He said, Jack, I want you to meet another mate of mine, Don Bradman. Meet Jack Charles. So at 15, I shook the hands of Donald Bradman. Unbelievable. And the boys at work, you know, they said, you know who that was, Jack? No, I didn't know who that was. I'm not a sporty type, really, you know. And since then, I said, wow, I shook the hand of a real legend here. And the irony is, my second gig with the ABC was with a series called Behind the Legend, and I had to play Eddie Gilbert, the hotshot fast bowler from Cherbourg, who bowls Donald Bradman out twice for a duck.
So it came around full circle then.
It came out full circle, mate.
So you said you were asking Mrs. Murphy, your foster mother, who you called Mum.
Yeah, I am.
You asked her repeatedly about how you suspected you might have some brothers and sisters. What made you think that you might have?
Well, I told them about the young fella that came into Box Hill a month before I left, and his last name was Charles, Arthur Charles.
And what did you say when you met him?
I said, I've met him, you know, a fella that might be my brother. You know, I knew that Mrs. Murphy wasn't a religious woman, so I used to sneak out my bedroom window to go to the Methodist service in the Blackburn Village.
You used to sneak out to go to church?
Yes.
Wow.
On a Sunday night.
I don't know if that's very naughty or very unnaughty.
Well, it's very naughty. Is it
right?
Because she came in one time into the church, bold as brass, dragged me out by my ear. I was very upset with the rest of the church people. How dare you take my boy out? You know, how dare you have my boy? He's got to go to work tomorrow.
Get out of that church. Right.
So,
right.
But I kept on going back to that church mob. We had a little group there, you know, a social group. And at one time, we traipsed on up to the Nuttlebodding Girls' Home to put on a concert for all those little girls there. And amongst all those girls were these two little waif-like Aboriginal children, and of course I just had to go up and ask them their names. The elder of the two shyly responds, "I'm Esme, and this, my sister Eva Joan." "Well, what are your last names?" I inquired. "Charles," she says. "Charles? Well, I'm a Charles too, ladies. Wouldn't it be funny if we were brothers and sisters?" And we were. The system in Box Hill and at Winlayton just was not allowed to tell us that we were indeed brothers and sisters.
So what was it that made you interested in finding out who you might be related to? What got you to actually take some action in that regard, Jack?
Well, also in the 50s, sometime mid-50s, an uncle and auntie of mine came into the Box Hill Boys' Home to take me out for a picnic. Henry and Amy Charles. They came in this big flash Chevrolet and took me over to Surrey Park across the home. And it was wonderful. And they said, "I'm your uncle and this is your auntie." And they didn't come back the next Sunday, although I'd gone to my locker and put on my Sunday best the next Sunday for, you know, another visitation, but it never happened.
So you knew you had relatives somewhere?
I knew I had relatives because they said, you know.
So where did you go looking for family once you wanted to start trying to find out who your family was?
Well, the first time going in at, 16, just before 17, nearly finishing off my apprentice, was at the behest of the boys at work. They said, "A lot of you black fellas over in Fitzroy, Jack, you know. Bet you got family amongst them. You go see for yourself." So I went to Fitzroy, took the bullet, went on a Thursday night with a full pay packet that I normally have to take home to Mrs. Murphy unopened.
And what happened when you got off the tram at the corner of Napier and Gore Street?
I jumped off the tram on the corner of Napier and Gertrude Street when this old black fella pulls me up. Charles, you Blanchy, Charles's boy. And, of course, I shat myself. This old fella, he grabs me and hugs me and kisses me. He's recognised me. We can recognise people, us Indigenous people, even though we don't know who we are. Those, you know, many of the Charleses then were small people. I was small. I looked like my mum and I looked like my sisters, apparently, too.
How long had you been standing on the street before someone came up and said, you're Blanchy Charles'
son? As soon as I jumped off that tram, he was walking past. So this old fellow, he grabbed me and he, you know, as I said, after this hugging and kissing business, he force-marched me up to the Builder's Arms. And, of course, I never entered another world when I walk into that building.
You hadn't been in a pub before?
I've never been in a pub before. I'm Jack Charles. Jesus Christ. You know, I couldn't, you know, I'm not a drinker. So I walked in and every face in the place seemed to be black. And he's saying, isn't Blanchy Charles's boy here? So people are coming up to me saying that they're my uncle, auntie, you know, cousins and that. And then, you know, so I'm truly overwhelmed with their beery hugs and kisses and that. And then one old lady croaked, your mum's living up in Swan Hill, young fella. You should go and see her. So I tell her, first chance I get.
What did that do to you to discover your mum's living up near Swan Hill in Victoria?
Well, it opened the wider world for me. I had great intentions of going back to mum, telling her. Even then, I thought, Christmas holiday's coming up soon. I'll go up then.
And aside from all that, what was it like being in a room full of Aboriginal men and women?
Pretty scary.
Really?
Oh, yes.
You didn't feel like these are my people?
Yes, pretty scary, you know, but at the same time, I was very welcomed at the same time, you know.
So when you left the pub, what happened when you got back home just to meet Mrs. Murphy?
Well, I jumped up on the door stoop and said, joy, oh joy, Mum, I just found Mum. I expected her to share my joy, but no such luck. She wrangled the story out of me. My night in a Fitzroy pub being recognised as a Charles, but worse still, my pay packet ripped open and a third of it spent. This riles her no end. She comes at me. Those people will tell you anything. Yeah, well, I say I'm raising my hand. Am I going to hit her? I see the fright in her eyes. Get to bed, she hisses before backing off. No sooner had I put on my pyjamas and settled down for the night when she calls me to the front door. A police divvy wagon's parked in the drive and I'm driven over to Royal Park Home for Juvenile Offenders. Richard, I was a ward of the state, a child of the Crown and would have been until I'm 18, and that woman I've called Mum had deemed me unruly, disobedient. So for the first time, I remember being locked alone in a cell, crying myself to sleep.
How did that work? How could you be arrested and incarcerated?
It was a jailing offence, so I got locked up for that.
For what offence? What had you done?
For going into Collingwood Fitzroy, mixing up with other blackfellas and that, you know, finding my roots.
What act did you break? What, the Assimilation Act or something?
Probably the Assimilation Act, yes. And I don't know, but it was a jailing offence for many of us who had endured the homes and who failed our foster and adopted people were locked up in jail. I saw the next day, the light of day, you know. It was the first of what becomes for me a series of incarcerations. When I get let out the next morning, there I see many of the other failed, Brian Orr and all these other fellas that had failed their foster and adopted people.
Jack, your foster mother, Mrs. Murphy, she'd been, I suppose, kind to you? And
she was kind, yes.
But she called the police to take you away?
Yeah, well, I did raise my hand.
What, this was...
And I was so pissed off with her for not believing me when I said these were that I had.
Why did she do that? She was a spite. Was it because I found my real mum? Is that what it is?
Yes, and finally realising it was the end of a good thing. Her favourite little Aboriginal boy, son, was moving away from her, out of her control, and that, and was fending for himself.
Yeah, you know, Jack, I think you know, all of us parents have that with our kids, but we don't call the cops.
Well, no.
You know, that's... Did you feel betrayed.
Oh, yes. I felt very slight, very, really upset. And
were
it took
you
me some
back-
time to go back to collect my state bank book.
So she didn't want you in the house anymore after
she
that?
Didn't want me anymore, yeah. But, you know, ironically, my boss rang her up and said, "Where's my favourite little Aboriginal worker?" "Oh, he's locked up in, you know, so-and-so, you know." So he came and bailed me out.
Your boss bailed you out?
Bailed me out and put me in a gentleman's residence in Glenferrie. And, within walking space of Auburn where I worked. And being independent, you know. Still a year off becoming 18 that I started to fend for myself, started to think for myself, have nobody really ordering me about. I never saw any sign of any welfare board member after that. I had failed the welfare system, and they didn't want to have a bar to deal with me anymore. So I had the notion I would write to the Swan Hill Police and find out if they know of my mum. And, of course, I got a letter from the sergeant. Said, "Yes, Jack, I know your mum. She's living here on the Edwards River, between Moolamine and Swan Hill." And I said, "Well, I intend to come up the next Christmas holidays, 3 weeks I've got from work." And I told my boss, I said, "Well, I'll book you a flight up there, Jack."
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So your boss wanted you back at the job
after this. Yes, he loved
me. He was lovely to you.
I love the work ethic.
And you loved all that.
Yes.
How then were you introduced to a life of crime from there?
There's the rub, you see. Being delivered into Glenferrie led me to where all these young criminals set on a life of crime already by the time I arrived there. So I was in a gentleman's residence nearby, and we used to meet up at Ziegfeld's Dance. Many of us would go there. I was always on the side of looking at the gentlemen's, really, you know. But I do remember one fellow saying to me, "Jack, you want to do a burg with me?" "What's a burg? What do you mean, what's a burg?" He says, "Well, break into a shop and that, you know, burglary." Impressionable me. I must have fancied him. His name was John English. He was a beautiful kid, and I wanted to do his bidding. A pretty boy. And he got the safe, I got the cigarettes. But he'd thrown the lolly machine directly through the front window, and he landed straight into the arms of the Jacks. They were there waiting for him. And by the time I got to my gentleman's residence, the Jacks and him were sitting on my bed waiting for me.
So you were done for breaking and entering?
Breaking and entering.
Right.
Jailed immediately.
So that's your second time you'd been incarcerated.
Yes, but in Pentridge this time.
What did you make of Pentridge when you got
there? Yeah, Pentridge, yes. It was exciting to be in Pentridge, mate, you know. A lot of other Box Hill boys' home boys were there, Boywood and Bayswater boys' homes were there. Already gangsters, many of them, and that.
So you knew people already?
Oh, yes, I knew a lot of people there. I walked in with ox blood, putty-toed shoes. I was a sight. And I was, you know, the well-spoken little Aboriginal fella who, if you give him some tailor-made or some chockey, he'll write your letters for you.
So out of prison, you went back to work at the glass factory. Again, this boss seemed to be really quite lovely with you. And this was around about the time you decided you would try and make contact with your mum, who you heard was near Swan Hill. How did you do that, Jack?
Well, I took my leave. I said to Alpha, "Look, I'm going up to Swan Hill. I'm meeting mum." I said, "Oh, that's right, Jack, okay. So here's some extra money, a bonus. We're giving you a bonus, Jack, and I'll pay for that flight."
God, he was a very nice man, wasn't he?
Wonderful, mate. Right. You know, I couldn't have done it because of him, you know. I did it because of him. You know, he allowed that to happen. And so I flew up to Swan Hill and landed there. That was wonderful, flying in a plane. My first experience of that, you know. We landed at Swan Hill, and there was the sergeant from Swan Hill Police. So drove us into Swan Hill and took us around across the border to the Federal Hotel. and left us around the back of the hotel, and I saw all these little huts, the blackfella camp, looked like something out of a slave quarters in the deep south in America. Now he said, stay here, I'll arrange for a lift to take you to your mum, Jack. And Jack, I suggest you buy a carton of Melbourne Bitter. Your mum likes to drink, Jack. Those were his exact words. Oh, I will, I will. So I bought a carton of Melbourne Bitter, put it next to my property in my luggage, and it was a couple of hours before I was due to be picked up by this old couple. So I thought I'd go to the Swan Hill bars and have a swim first, you know. So I crossed over the board and walked up to the Swan Hill bars and that, and I'm standing there and get out me money and about to pay, and the woman says, oh, I'm not allowed to swim there. I says, no, I got the money, you got the money. And he said, no, we don't allow you to swim here. You've got to go to the Murray there. And so I'm so nonplussed. This is my first experience of country racism and that. I'm so struck dead, you know. The big fella behind me with his kids picked me up and just set me aside and plopped me down, you know.
Well, get out the way.
Get out of the way, young fella.
So what happened when this couple picked you up?
Yes, they took us out to, we know where your mum lives, we know the property there, Jack, so we'll take you all the way. And so we go to their property where mum lives and that, and then we drove along this wonderful driveway and I see a beautiful white house in the distance. Oh, that looks nice, you know. She lives there, eh? And suddenly we veer off a track into gutted track, you know, and there's this hubby and 12 whippet dogs and 2 Ford prefects, and there's my mum waddling towards me. And it was my first sighting of my mum waddling toward me.
How did your mum look to you when she was walking towards you?
Well, looked a little like me, only larger, beautiful black hair. We hugged each other for a long time. It's good to see you, son. Remember, I'm the firstborn. I was the first one taken. And she welcomed the beer. I realised that she did like the drink. There was a bed set up for me outside under a canvas roof. It was hard to get anything out of her. I hadn't realised that she was there, basically, ostracised by the rest of New South Wales and Victoria.
Why was she ostracised?
Because of that murder in the 50s.
What was that murder?
That murder was the payback law for this man's behaviour towards the children and the women in the blackfella camp up in Griffiths. She was the one that called the meeting. She was commonly called the sergeant. People still know her, my mum, as the sergeant.
That was her nickname?
That was her nickname, the sergeant.
So she'd organised, what, some Aboriginal law?
Payback law.
Payback law.
Against this man's behaviour towards the women and the children in the camp and other men's women's.
And for that, she was ostracised?
Oh, yes.
So there she is on the outside, on the outside of both societies then?
On the outer. And when we did go in to pop up my bank account, you know, take your money out of my bank and that, she would have a lot of arguments with some of those women in the blackfella camp. And she would go off at me too.
How many kids did she have taken from her, Jack?
Well, 11. All 11. 2 died at birth. So all 11 kids were taken. She never got to raise any of us. She got to raise Esme and Eva Jo and Artie until they were little ones, and then they were taken. So each and every one of us were taken, and the last one, Zenith, was taken shortly thereafter. Yes.
Does that explain to your mind? Does that explain her behaviour?
Yes, it explains why her behaviour. And I think somehow or another my addiction might have set me apart. But I made an effort to be part of her life.
Oh, did you think you might be a bit too high and mighty then, did you?
Yeah, Clary and her job was to look after the 5 surrounding farmlets. And so I learned to drive a Ford Prefect utility. You know, Mum used to do it, but, you know, down to me, now I'm the man. And we'd go into one of the properties around nearby to help keep the rabbit population down. And remember, they were 5 shillings a pelt in those days. And so I had to learn to break a rabbit's neck.
So you spent some time there and lived the life.
I lived the life. I didn't go back to work, as a matter of fact.
And did you
I sent a telegram back to boss saying, I'm not coming back. If I'm going along to Murray, I'm going to do some work and see if I can do some jackarooing and that. So I did leave mum because the drinking really got to hold of me and I didn't like it that much. So I went along and I worked on a property at Findlay. It was a real harsh life and I didn't like it. I was on my own. But I was willing to have a go at bush life. You know, if I'm an Aboriginal, I must, you know, get to understand what it's like working along the Murray and that, like Mum did. And I liked the bag sewing with her. I liked catching the odd snake and the turtle, eating all that kind of stuff. It was a great experience.
Were you able to bond with your mum, or was she just too damaged in the end?
She had been too damaged by the whole system, and it was impossible for us really to bond. So that's why I did leave. And then after a year, I went back to Melbourne, and I was discovered by the new theatre there.
So this is where your life in acting begins, being discovered by the new theatre, which I think was a leftist theatre.
Oh, yes, commonly called the Pink Theatre.
Pink Theatre. Were you a Marxist-Leninist in those days, Jack? Or was that not really your cap? So once you had a taste of the spotlight as an actor on stage, how much did you like it, Jack?
All of it.
All of it? Every bit of it?
Yeah, even the makeup. They came in wanting to recruit to play African-Americans in Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. And years later, I found out it was a Sidney Poitier movie. I did it. I raised my hand, and I followed Ronnie Northrop.
So you loved it. You absolutely loved it.
I loved it. I aped him playing Bobo, and I couldn't cry instantly. So I used to have a smoke in the backstage and put the smoke under my eyes, and I'd be tearing up by the time I got on stage. And we did a lot of political comical reviews and musicals and that. And I thought that, well, this is where I need to be. This is just great. And that's where I first found Jack, or Jack found me.
You fell in love with a man also named Jack at the time. Did that make you happy for a while?
It did. Yes, for 5 years.
5 years. You say, nonetheless, it was doomed to fail in your book. Why do you think it was doomed to fail?
I never had anybody really love me, and I never had any experience in loving anybody else.
Did he say, I love you, to you?
Well, he did straight away, and I said, well, you better stay the night.
So what led you to start taking drugs to the point of becoming addicted to them then, Jack?
Well, I think it was well after, you know, Jack had left. In Dimboola, all the actors were allowed to drink.
And you sit there and you just drink beer throughout the whole performance.
And I was partnered with Max Gillies as the gate crasher. I think I was Mutton or Bainett that had a touch of the tar in him and that, you know. But I was in jail when they made the movie of it.
So this is when your career as a cat burglar really kicked in.
Yeah, kicked in off, and then, you know, but yeah, yes. So between these gigs, I was doing burgs and that, you know.
So was this to
fund
your drug?
But the other thing with alcohol was that I was doing also varsity. And I was drinking heavily after each show, especially after the show in Dimboola. I was drinking a lot of heavy, and I had a motorbike at the time. I don't know why I survived. Anyway, after Dimboola, after varsity, a young fella said, come and join me and partake of my father's Reds. He lived just across the road next door to the police station in Drummond Street. And he said, my father's Reds. I think his father was a doctor from Hawthorne Football Club. Beautiful wine. And I bumped into him. I was doing the Ligon limbo as you could in those days, and I bumped into him and I said hello to him, and he was very upset with me, and I couldn't understand why he was upset with me. But he realised I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, so he sat me down. He said, Jack, do you remember that night after varsity had finished, the last night, you know, we had a drink at my place? I said, yeah, I remember, yeah. Do you remember anything else, Jack? No, I can't. Well, Jack, look, we were getting along fine, but we had an argument over something that we shouldn't have had an argument over. You went into my kitchen, Jack. You went into my cutlery drawer, and you drew out a steak knife, and you came into the lounge, come up real close to me, Jack, and you bent that knife right in front of my face, and then you straightened it out, and then you went out to my Morgan, and you knifed all four tyres, Jack. You jumped on your bike, and your stack hat's still on my veranda. Go and get it.
And you had no memory of that?
No memory. So instantly, I gave up drinking for 8 years after that, because I instantly thought it could have been him I might have stabbed. And that's when I said to one of the Pram Factory people, who I knew was shooting up, he said, give me a shot of that. I forced it out of him.
Why? Why did you do that?
Well,
wanted something other than drink, or is that what it was?
Yeah, well, you know, drinking was hiding, you know, was making life bearable for me as an Aboriginal, as a loner. As a gay Aboriginal too, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, somebody that's not quite comfortable in my skin in those days. So it's taken me many years of discovery to be comfortable with who I am.
So what did taking heroin do then? What was the feeling it gave you?
Well, instant euphoria. You forget your pains. You can put, your angst, your anxieties, your fears aside, or leave them aside. They're always there still. And that, but you leave them aside and you're strengthened. to play the silly bugger and do the wrong things ever more so.
So to finance this habit, you eventually started doing cat burglaries again mainly through wealthy suburbs in Melbourne, like Kew.
Well, over the other side of the Yarra, invariably.
When you're doing that, is it a frightening thing? Are you frightened?
Always a frightening thing. When you actually go up the drive, that's when the frighteners turn on. Right? You know what you're doing. I know what I'm doing is wrong, but I'm there on a job to rob and steal money. Normally, I'd be happy if the cars were unlocked, the three or four, two cars in the garage were unlocked, and I was safe with getting something out of the car. Sometimes I'd get thousands out of a car, thousands, 56 grand out of one car, and 36 again the next month out of the same car. This is really strange. Never reported to the Camberwell police.
56 grand?
I owned up to these crimes, and the police go back and say, was your car broken into and this amount of money stolen? And years later, and they said, no. So it's black money.
Right, you're stealing from another crook in that case. Well, that's certainly...
Stealing from another crook.
How do you reflect on those break-ins now?
I reflect differently now, but at the time, you know, I was a stolen child. I was stolen, and by stealth I'd entered this home, and I had taken money by stealth, and I'd been given some measure of payback. I worked it that way. Yeah, as I say, justifications for many of our crimes were easily justified. And simply, in the simplest of terms with an Indigenous people, well, I stole my country, stole my land, stole me from my mum, stole my life, and that's all I'm stealing back. These are the people over in Toorak and Kew and Kooyong that are making the rules that are suppressing my people. So I felt heartened every time I had a successful night. And I always, you know, in those days, discovering a family, I was sharing the wealth. In the fridges, in the garages of these large places, there's always special freezers and fridges and that for top shelf meat and that, you know, silver side and that. And I'd laden my dilly bag with that also to take home to my newly found sisters.
Still, you're kind of violating their sense of safety.
Oh, you violate their safety in that. But then again, I reflect on the violations of my kinfolk in the past that have been violated, raped and murdered. I never raped and murdered anybody. So it was as simple as that.
Tell me about the night you were busted in a bungalow in Kew.
I had a torch in my mouth going through the front bedroom, you know, through the drawer next to the bed.
And the house was empty?
The house was empty. And this car turned in this roundabout drive and its headlights caught me like a moth, you know. And I heard the bloke yell out, "Hey, get your eyes, stop there, I got you," you know. He had apparently jumped out of the car and come flying through the front door, and I'd only had time to duck into the cupboard and that, you know. So he knew where I was, you know, instantly. And he grabbed himself a weapon and he said, "Come out of there, I know you're in there, I'm armed," and that's a... I came out and he took one look at me and dropped the brolly. He was so shocked to see a little diminutive black fella there in his bedroom. You know, "What are you doing here?" "I'm robbing you, mate. Sorry, mate." He said, "What are you taking?" "Nothing. I just got started. Just gone to the drawer there." "Well, empty your pockets out, you know." She's finished parking the Rover around the back by then. She's come through the kitchen. "Have you got him, love? Have you got him?" "Yes, he's in the bedroom here. Call the police." "No, I don't want to see him." "No, call the police. I want to see him first." So she comes in. She takes one look at me and she says, "You're Jack Charles." She'd seen partially the play.
She'd seen you on stage?
She saw me on stage.
She recognised you as an actor?
Instantly. I tried to feel so small.
How did it... Oh, my God.
I was so embarrassed. So she... "Jack, let's go into the kitchen, have a cup of tea, and we'll talk about this."
And you were mortified?
I was mortified.
Right. And what did she say to you when she gave you a cup of tea?
Well, he was the same like-minded too. He'd seen the play. Had a couple of fans there. So we had a cup of tea. And I said, "Well, Jack, we'll let you go. We won't talk to the police. We don't care what you do to the rest of the neighbourhood here. We don't know them." I hung around to see if they had. True to their word, they didn't. I always wanted them to come out to revisit, to check on me. Just, "Do you remember us? We were the ones that you robbed and, you know, we didn't allow you to have a chance to rob us because we busted you and we let you go. That's never occurred to me. But I always wonder if these people would see Bastardy the Docker, if they'd seen me doing Rake, Wolf Creek, Clever Man, all these black comedy, Chanted Jimmy Baxman.
You're living this really unusual life at this point. You're acting all the time in theatre productions with the Pram Factory and with the black theatre company you founded with Bob Mazza back in the day, doing these extraordinary things. At the same time, you're kind of a functioning heroin addict and doing cat burglaries to fund that as well, and being homeless at times and then sleeping in nice hotels at other times. It's a really strange kind of disjointed lifestyle. Tell me the story of how, during this period, you came to be stark bollocks naked on the stage of the Sydney Opera House. Please, Jack. How did that come about?
What a hoot. We were doing The Cradle of Hercules, written by Michael Boddy for the Alto Theatre Company. And they pulled me up from Melbourne and Gulpilil from Manning Reader, and 17 Alto Theatre members, all of us ex-New Theatre people, and 6 girls from Redfern. Now, I never knew them. I'd never been to Redfern. And I wasn't certain of my footing, but I was amazed that somehow Eora people would allow me to be playing the part of Bennelong. Okay, so I find the girls coming up to my dressing room shortly before we're due to perform, and they said, "Jack, we've just been told that we're not going to be paid the performance money and that we have to remain on the rehearsal money." And I said, "Oh, that sounds unfair, girls, you know. So do you want me to speak up for you?" Yeah, said, "Please, Mr. Charles, can you do that?" I said, "Of course I will. We're ex-New Theatre people, for Christ's sake, you know." So I go up to George Whaley and Robin, whatever his name was. I said, "Listen, you know, why are these girls not being paid the same as Gulpilil and I, you know?" "Oh, they're casual, Jack." "I'm casual, even though you had me for 2 plays, and Gulpilil's casual, only 1 play. And so I don't reckon it's right." You know, I was heavy drinking and getting into drugs too. And I said, "Well, listen, I can't really do the show because this is not my country. And so you have to pay those girls, otherwise I'll pack my dog and my bag and go back to Melbourne. I'm not allowed to be in the country if you're not paying these girls." And so they waited for the 11th hour, and I'd already packed the dog and the bag. And I was so pissed off when George came up and said, "Well, all right, and Robin, I'm going to pay them, Jack." Then I said, "Look, I'm going to play Bennelong naked, buggies. Jack, please, you know. Like, please, can you reconsider?" So the Opera House management and the Alto Theatre management tried to dissuade me otherwise. So we're down there for the first run and all that, showing Gulpilil what I was going to do. And there was Gulpilil on the side of the stage all lappied up. And I said, "Jay, aren't we going to do this naked?" "It is a strange conversation to be had on the side of the stage, Richard." He said, "You're no man." I said, "What? What do you mean I'm no man?" And the stage manager, a gay, arty little fella, said, "Look, Jack, I think I know what's happening on here, dear. Look, go and do your thing. And when you come back, I'll tell you what I suspect is happening." I said, "Okay." So I get shaved and washed in a tin tub on stage, and I come off, you know, and he says, "Here, what?" He said, "Well, I believe he's wearing that out of respect for you, Jack." "What do you mean, out of respect for me?" "Well, it's plainly obvious, Jack, there, that you've not been initiated." So this was the kind of conversation we were having backstage.
That's a very strange conversation to be having.
It is. It's one of the best conversations I've ever had backstage with a stage manager.
So did you walk on naked in the end?
Yes.
You did?
I got a standing ovation on the opening night.
And that was out of revenge for them being so bloody-minded about not paying those women properly.
And I do remember the ladies down at the MLC there when my legs were dangling over the side of the stage, licking their lips and that, you know, cheeky little girls.
Well, they're only human, Jack.
But yes, I made an impression in the theatre. I became an instant rebel here in Sydney. And I've always had seeming problems because of that. You know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. It was just wrong for them to have done that. I might have slighted Gulpilil by doing that, but no. We did the play, and it was done and dusted with.
Eventually, it took a long while for you to kick the habit of heroin.
I think you were
60 or something when you kicked it.
Yes.
What persuaded you to kick it?
A Murramali program delivered by Auntie Lorraine Peters and her daughter in my last jail sentence.
But what made you want to kick it? What made you want to go to them? You just got
sick of it? I didn't go to them. I did naturally. If anybody delivered a program in the jail, I'd naturally go to it. If it was Aboriginal, and it tweet with me. They gave us information about the potential of what is yet to be discovered about our heritage and why it has been denied us. And we were so pissed off with what we had been denied us. I personally felt that I had a need to relit the burning embers of my grogged up, drugged up, mucked up dreamings. Totally. I had this notion of coming out to my community, Collingwood Fitzroy's Fetterfoot Kadaitaman lawman. I needed to be seen as a leading black light in my own community. I was beginning to discover who I ought to be and what I ought to become.
So you wanted to aspire to the dignity of that?
Yes, yes, yes. And I came out. It took me 2 years to jump off the methadone, 2 years to finish off the doco, 2 years to learn, going through the Elder Skills course, run through Canberra, going through various destinations, seeing other men from all over the continent, women in another conference centre, but me getting to understand the roots of problems of elders and men trying to aspire to be elders in their own communities, all meeting on the one ground. And I realised I had this unique voice, this unique memory, and this unique drive to become sincerely a truly an elder statesman person in my own right.
Well, you are acknowledged as an elder statesman. You have been awarded as Victorian Senior Australian of the Year, and you are called Uncle Jack.
Now,
you are acknowledged as an elder. As such, you very much want to be one of those elders that goes into prisons.
Yeah.
And to be the kind of person you needed when you were young and in prison. Is that possible for you? What do you want them to know?
That it's never impossible to reach my level. Come with me. You ought to be more than you are at the moment. And that's what I take into prisons, trying to impress those that are struggling with their own lives, you know, looking for direction, looking for support, and that I could be that person. Allow me to put you on a right road, give you guidance and directions.
You say you know who you are these days, Jack. Who are you?
I'm Uncle Jack Charles. A totally born again black fella, now beyond reproach, the rigidage, not true blue, but true black. You know, I've regained that which has been denied me, and I'm all the more powerful and empowered because I know that my roots are firmly stuck in Melbourne and all across New South Wales.
Well, I believe you're a black fella.
Jack, you're
I believe
Richard.
It. I do. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're extraordinary. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you, mate.
That was my conversation with Jack Charles from last year. Jack's book is called Born Again Blackfella. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.